Chapter 15. The Death Spiral. The death spiral is a doubles figure skating maneuver in which the larger skater, read the man, pivots on one toe while holding the hand of the smaller skater, read the woman, who whirls around him in a supine position as her head reaches closer and closer to the ice. Centripetal force pulls her back up. That's where America finds itself now, in a death spiral, a virtual healthcare vortex, flirting with oblivion from which it seems impossible to escape. But there's no force trying to pull us back up. In fact, the centrifugal forces just push us closer to the brink. Obesity, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, cancer, and dementia are among a set of diseases known collectively as metabolic syndrome, and they threaten to bring our entire healthcare system to its knees. They are certainly devastating to the people suffering from them. Over 88% of Americans surveyed said that they would rather be healthy than rich, yet only 37% believe that they will enjoy good health 10 years from now. Furthermore, 80% of all respondents over 50 already have at least one disease of metabolic syndrome. If they would rather be healthy than rich, they're doing a pretty lousy job. But they aren't the only ones suffering. Treating each of these conditions is expensive, and all of society pays the price in taxes and higher insurance premiums. Ultimately, metabolic syndrome will be the straw that breaks Medicare's back. Currently, 9.4% of the adult American population is diabetic, and another 40% is pre-diabetic. But this is not just our problem. The same struggle is being fought around the world. Great Britain, Australia, Japan, Mexico, and South Korea are all experiencing the same bankrupting of healthcare due to the same diseases. And Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, UAE, and Malaysia are now at 80% obesity and 18% diabetes. Even with all their oil money, they can't support and underwrite this level of illness. A legal Ponzi scheme. Where could these diseases be coming from? Everyone assumes this is the result of the obesity epidemic. Too many calories in, too few out. Children and adults are getting fat, so they're getting sick. But here's the rub. While 80% of the obese population is metabolically ill, that means that 20% are not. They are what we call metabolically healthy obese, or MHO. They will live a completely normal life, die at a normal age, and not cost the taxpayer a dime. They are not contributing to the death spiral. Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population harbors these same diseases, but they're not obese. If normal weight people get them as well, how is this related to obesity? Rather, we now know that obesity is a marker rather than a cause of metabolic syndrome. There's no question that more people, especially the poor, are getting the diseases of metabolic syndrome. This is in part due to population growth. Where there are more people, there are also more sick people. But 2015 saw an increase in age-adjusted mortality rates for all the diseases of metabolic syndrome. Heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, diabetes, and kidney disease. And it isn't just that more people are getting these diseases. That's called incidence. Technological and medical advances mean that people are able to live longer than ever before, meaning that there are more people who have the disease at any given time, called prevalence. Yes, we can keep these sick people alive longer, but a longer life isn't necessarily a better one, and certainly not a cheaper one. The increasing incidence, prevalence, and severity of all of these chronic metabolic diseases, the price of their treatments, and the fact that patients can simmer along debilitated for years, is why healthcare is going broke. Stanford economist Raj Chetty demonstrated that personal income directly correlates with lifespan. The less money you have, the quicker you die. Yet, neither poverty nor minority status underlies the reason for the changes in U.S. mortality statistics over the 2005 to 2015 decade. We keep old sick people alive longer, which costs a lot of money. This expense should be offset by healthy young people paying in. Yet we're losing them to drug overdoses, addiction, and complications from metabolic syndrome. This is felt in all branches of government, but nowhere more so than Social Security. Social Security is a legal Ponzi or pyramid scheme. Lots of young people at the bottom of the pyramid pay in with the expectation that the money will be there once they make it to the top. The only difference between Social Security and Bernie Madoff is that the U.S. Treasury holds the money and, if you're lucky, pays it out. But Social Security is in crisis in every country. In order for Social Security to be healthy, you need lots of healthy young people at the bottom paying in, with the fewest old sick people taking it out at the top. Social Security in the U.S. started to falter in the late 1990s. Before that, our government had the ideal paradigm. We had a nation of smokers. Even though we knew that U.S. Surgeon General Luther Terry's 1964 report categorically demonstrated that smoking kills, the U.S. government did little to curtail smoking for the next 30 years. Why? Because the actuaries determined that smoking killed you at a mean age of 64, 1 year before you started to collect Social Security. And the insurers were delighted because you could only spend so much money on lung cancer, which would kill you in an average of 6 months. So you had healthy young people paying in and then dropping dead just before they started to take out. The ultimate Ponzi scheme. But instead, what if the young people are sick? What if the young people are on disability due to chronic disease? Now we're talking about diseases that don't kill you quick, like lung cancer. We're talking diabetes, fatty liver disease, heart disease, kidney failure, diseases that take 20 years of misery and money before you succumb. Worse yet, what if Social Security is paying out to all of these debilitated young people in benefits? When the base of the pyramid crumbles, the whole structure collapses. And that is what is happening right now all over the world. My good friend Juan Lozano Tovar, currently head of Social Security for the government of Mexico, convened a symposium on the future of international Social Security at MIT in May of 2015. At this symposium, we discussed economics, pensions, aging, and genetics. The elephant in the room was the epidemic of chronic disease in young people. I see 10-year-olds with type 2 diabetes every day. They'll likely be on long-term disability and never hold a job. When the money goes out instead of coming in, everything else is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Eating away at the base of the pyramid. One big portion of the problem is that we have focused all of our efforts on healthcare rather than health, on treatment instead of prevention. We plow billions of dollars into drugs and surgeries and nutraceuticals, some of which have in fact reduced death rates, but none of which has reduced the actual rates of disease. In the good old days, we got sick and we died. Now, is that good? Well, it is if you want to keep a healthcare system afloat. Today, fewer people are dying from heart disease or diabetes because we have treatments to keep them alive. Now they hang around, with compromised worker productivity detracting from the positive side of the economic ledger. Yet they rack up higher medical costs, increasing the negative side of the financial ledger as well. In fact, all of our medical technologies have allowed us to tread water, but they haven't rescued us from the pool. We've just delayed the drowning. We are literally in the throes of the death spiral, with a vortex so strong we can't escape the forces dragging us downward. Why is this happening? What is the cause of this death spiral? Either we're so unhappy that we're killing ourselves, or we're under the malicious spell of some external force that is powering this tornado. Are our opioid crisis and our metabolic syndrome crisis related? What is the connection between happiness, health, healthcare, and lifespan? Happily ever after. There's no question that innate happiness predicts a longer life. A group of American nuns were asked to write an autobiography in their 20s, and their writings were analyzed for content on well-being and positive affect. Those who exhibited contentment lived to an older age than those who did not. But was that because those who were happy didn't find the need to engage in more problematic behavior like smoking or alcohol, neither of which is forbidden by the church? Okay, but those are nuns. A more recent and complete assessment of different populations internationally suggests that high subjective well-being and life satisfaction predicts longevity irrespective of economic status, although it doesn't necessarily extend the lives of people who are afflicted with chronic disease. Conversely, poor health clearly causes unhappiness, and poor health is a primary predictor of mortality. But does unhappiness cause mortality directly? In the case of suicide, unequivocally, yes. And those who are stressed, unhappy, and yearning for contentment often seek a consolation prize in the form of reward, thus breeding a host of lifestyle factors associated with skewed dopamine, such as alcohol, tobacco, and street drugs. So which kills you, the behaviors or the unhappiness? Three recent studies, two from the United Kingdom and one from the U.S., start to answer this question. First, a British longitudinal study of men and women ages 50 and older modeled the role that happiness plays in predicting a longer life. Happiness was assessed using a 4-point questionnaire. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy the company of others. I look back with a sense of happiness. I feel full of energy. Of note is that this study took into account both depression and the diseases of metabolic syndrome, like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, impaired mobility, chronic lung disease, in the model, but did not ask about the behaviors that led to those diseases, like sedentary activity, bad food, smoking, alcohol, drugs, sleep debt. The results showed that of all those who had specific diseases, you were more likely to survive them if you were happy by a factor of 25%. However, the conclusion reached in the next study was somewhat different. In the UK Million Women study, postmenopausal women at a median age of 59 years were asked, "How happy are you?" About 40% said they were happy most of the time, 44% said some of the time, and 17% said none of the time. They asked these women to self-rate their own health. These investigators followed this group for 10 years. Death rate was definitely associated with poor health assessment at baseline, and poor health was associated with unhappiness. But after adjustment for self-rated health, reward-driven behaviors such as smoking and hedonic eating, and treatments with medicines for reward-related diseases, such as hypertension, diabetes, and also depression and anxiety, it turned out that these women's innate unhappiness played no role in their death rate from heart disease, cancer, or any other disease. The third U.S.-based study adds yet another piece to the puzzle. A group of adults had functional MRIs performed at baseline and then 3 to 4 years later, during which time 9% of the subjects suffered a heart attack. What was different about their brains that could be a predictor? Those who demonstrated the highest activities in the amygdala, the fear center, were the most likely to experience a cardiac event. The amygdala dampens function of your prefrontal cortex, putting you at risk for more self-destructive behaviors. What are we to make of these three seemingly different yet related studies? They tell us that unhappiness itself isn't the killer. Rather, it is likely that our fear and anxiety stoke our unhappiness, which drives us toward unhealthy behaviors, many of which are dopamine-driven, and it is these behaviors that increase morbidity, disability, and eventually mortality. Now, these studies don't answer directionality, which came first, the fear or the unhappiness. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. Behaviors continue to increase the force and the expense of the death spiral. It's all about how we seek pleasure in the absence of contentment, driving both addiction and depression, and where and how we have run off the rails. It's the cheap thrills that kill. And the cheap thrills are everywhere. But there is a silver lining here, because all of those cheap thrills are man-made. And they could be unmade, if we chose to. The tragedy of the commons. Healthcare and Social Security are finite resources. There's only so much money in the pipeline. In the past, we've just upped the dollars devoted to healthcare. In 1965, healthcare amounted to 5% of gross domestic product. In 2014, healthcare took up 17.5% of GDP. And by 2022, it is projected to be 19.9%. But now we can't print money fast enough to afford this. The money's dried up. When such finite monetary resources are used indiscriminately by everyone, we suffer from the paradigm known as the tragedy of the commons. The principle is this. You have a big field where all the farmers graze their cattle. When there are few cattle, there's no problem. But when farmers buy more cattle and let them graze to their heart's content, soon there's no grass and no cattle. This is a well-documented principle by which a limited resource that is supposedly available for all is utilized by all and then disappears for all. This is what's happening to Social Security and healthcare. And, ostensibly, this was the basis for Obamacare. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, President Obama's healthcare advisor and architect of Obamacare, published an article in October 2014 in The Atlantic titled, "Why I Want to Die at 75. In it, he argues that healthcare has not extended the time of living, but rather has extended the time of dying. While we have increased the length of life, we have not contributed to improving either happiness or productivity. The data would argue that our paradigm of life, or death, extension, seems to have reached its zenith. Newer research argues that this is the first generation to live shorter lives than its parents. In Chapter 11, we noted that lifespan has started to decline. While the percentages might not seem like much, it's the slippery slope. Expect further lifespan reductions in the future, despite spending over one-fifth of our GDP on healthcare. Worse yet, Obamacare was predicated on a false premise, that the healthy people would pay for the sick people, and that access to a doctor would keep them out of the emergency room. The idea was that we could add 32 million sick people to the insurance rolls, and we would pay for this by providing preventative services, that is, having access to a doctor and by treating symptoms with medicines, like treating high cholesterol with statins, high blood pressure with angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, diabetes with oral hypoglycemic agents. Then you'd stay out of the emergency room where the costs are 50 times higher. Sounds good, but there's a catch. There are no services to prevent chronic metabolic disease that can be provided by the healthcare system. There's only treatment. We doctors can keep these people alive, but we can't stop people from getting heart disease or diabetes or fatty liver disease or kidney disease with pills. Just like we can't stop people from getting obese. And these treatments cost healthcare big bucks. Just look at how the rates of these diseases have continued to climb over the past 20 years, despite our full knowledge of the obesity epidemic. And once you've had your heart attack or stroke, or once you're in chronic kidney failure, you are nothing but a liability. You're just another head of cattle grazing on the commons. Why do you think three of the biggest health insurers, United, Aetna, and Humana, opted out of Obamacare? At a 15% profit cap, they couldn't keep up with all the sick people with diabetes. Yet we could all save money on chronic metabolic diseases if we could actually prevent them. Healthcare is sick care. Healthcare has been sucking at the teat of the federal government for decades. Everyone wants their share. Doctors, lawyers, and insurers were all natural-born enemies. After all, we doctors wasted the insurance company's profit on healthcare and its delivery. We demanded all modes of exorbitant therapy for our patients, including treatments that might prolong a patient's life for a few months. Never was this truer than in the good old heydays of health insurance. Big medicine relied on big treatment to generate big bucks. Treating chronic diseases, especially those with no cure, is expensive, and the markup is huge. The government negotiated with the American Medical Association to provide fee-for-service. Procedures became the cash cow, and the premiums reflected it. The doctors drove the bus, the insurance company charged higher rates, the employers anteed up, and the patients came to expect the magic of modern medicine. No talk of prevention. The results of prevention don't happen within one political cycle. Prevention requires a cultural shift. And that's political suicide, especially when there's money to be made. Prevention puts responsibility not just on the individual, but on society as a whole, including government. Prevention may sound good on a bumper sticker, but it doesn't make any money for doctors, for hospitals, for insurers, or for politicians, for that matter. Prevention is a zero-sum game. The costs associated with procedure-driven healthcare made doctors the bad guys through the last half of the 20th century. We doctors lost our credibility with Congress. This was the impetus for the expansion of HMOs to try to control doctors and, in turn, control costs. Except 43% of healthcare was spent on administration by the insurance companies. So who really wasted the money? But hey, just raise the premiums. Keep those profits rolling in. And the lawyers were happy to tap into all that largesse. Malpractice suits generated awards that topped $69 million a pop. At one point, almost 60% of all doctors had been sued for malpractice at least one time in their careers. All paid out of the insurer's profits. And so it was. But the tragedy of the commons means that the party is now over, and the grazing land has gone fallow. Academic medicine, Medicaid, Medicare, they're all on life support. And the bankruptcies are not due to physician salaries, which have decreased relative to inflation, or inpatient costs, or nursing costs, or infrastructure expenditures. It's due to chronic metabolic disease. These diseases aren't killing us outright. Instead, they're sucking us dry. And if you think that other people getting sick is their problem and not yours, chew on this. 65% of all healthcare expenditures are paid out of government dollars. That means your taxes. You're paying twice. More for your own insurance premium and more for everyone else, too. One question around which the 2016 election revolved is whether Obamacare worked. Well, as of 2016, 20 million people who were previously denied or could not afford insurance were able to obtain health insurance. Insurance company profits were capped at 15%. Any extra money that the insurance company took in had to be returned to its subscribers. So that should reduce corporate profits, right? Not necessarily. The large insurance plans have cut administrative costs to make the 85% minimum loss ratio, or MLR, but they hiked both premiums and deductibles so that it became harder to use the health care you got. This resulted in the big insurers making even more money and doling out bigger executive bonuses. Those three major insurers abandoned the state exchanges altogether, thus squeezing the rest. Because with 15% profit, they can't make money using the casino model anymore. The best way to make money now is to save it. That is, nobody gets sick, and no payout. Or make the premium so high that nobody uses it. And Trump Care, if passed, will continue to ignore the elephant in the room. More of the populace is sick and getting sicker. And they won't get better until there's a substantive change in the food supply. Trump Care's answer? Deny 24 million people health insurance. There is one good thing that did result from Obamacare that will likely remain, perhaps as an unintended consequence. Before Obamacare, insurance was based on the casino model. It was pay to play, and the insurance company, like the casino, set the payout. Under the casino model, the insurance company wanted you to get sick. More people getting sick was their excuse to raise the premiums and make more money. There was no impetus for prevention because there was no money in prevention. And decades ago, big business wasn't necessarily happy when people got sick, but it wasn't crying either, as CEOs could replace older employees who garnered high salaries and pensions with younger ones to whom they could pay lower salaries and who had never heard of pensions. But as the premiums grew, big business realized that insurance costs were cutting into their economic productivity, because they are now spending $2,751 per annum per employee for obesity-related diseases, whether the employee is obese or not. Nonetheless, because of the cap, for the first time in history, insurance companies actually want you to be healthy. So they're all paying for preventative care now. Now they want their payout to go down, and a healthy workforce is the only way to reduce those costs. Staying alive. But what if we had healthy 90-year-olds instead of sick 75-year-olds? My wife's grandmother lived on her own farm in rural Minnesota till the ripe old age of 101. Growing her own food, gardening, limiting her TV, and not seeing a doctor. Her family's single regret in her life was that when she hit 100, the Today Show's Willard Scott didn't mention her. What if we all consumed minimal healthcare resources in our old age because we were the epitome of health? What if we prevented the national exposure that drives economic, social, and medical devolution all at once? And what if we could all be happy at the same time? In Zeke Emanuel's Atlantic article, he never even addressed the biggest issue in this entire debacle. Diet. Could we turn this around? Could we save lives and money? We could, if we would just reduce the most ubiquitous dietary item that is driving it upward. The cheapest of thrills. Sugar. While there are likely many environmental factors involved in metabolic syndrome, the one we have causation for is sugar. Disability-adjusted life years, or DAILIES, are a way of determining the health and economic burden of a particular exposure or behavior. One study looked at the effects of sugar-sweetened beverages on DAILIES worldwide. What was interesting about this analysis was the breakdown by age group. Despite having the highest general disease rates, the over 65s were virtually untouched by sugar-sweetened beverages. Conversely, it was the 20 to 44-year-old age group that showed massive increases in DAILIES due to sugar-sweetened beverages. In other words, drinking sodas, juices, and sports drinks doesn't just hurt you when you're older. It hurts you now, when you're supposed to be at your top earning potential, when you're supposed to be paying into the system. In America, it's no better. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, also known as food stamps, is a $75 billion program that covers 15% of adult Americans and 33% of children. What do these people buy? Sugar beverages are number two, and some other form of sugar-containing food are numbers 4, 5, 10, 11, and 12, amounting to 27% of all expenditures. Why should we care what they buy with our taxpayer money? Because people who get their food on the SNAP program are 50% more likely to die of heart disease or diabetes than SNAP-eligible people who don't participate, and 3 times more likely than those who are SNAP-ineligible. My UCSF Global Health team looked at what would happen to the death spiral if we just cut back a little on our cheapest thrill, sugar. From our research on metabolic syndrome, we identified the development of liver fat as the single most important risk factor for developing the various diseases of metabolic syndrome. We then modeled how disease prevalence would change and how much money could be recouped if the United States engaged in a campaign to reduce our added sugar consumption, first by 20%, the amount that's targeted by the sugar-sweetened beverage taxes, such as the one in Philadelphia, and then by 50%, which would bring us to the 10% added sugar limit recommended by the new USDA dietary guidelines. The model was carried out going forward for 20 years, from 2015 to 2035. The results were astonishing. For instance, at a 20% reduction in added sugar consumption, cases of heart disease and diabetes in the U.S. would decrease by 0.1% and 0.2% with healthcare savings of $10 billion, while a more restrictive 50% reduction in added sugar consumption would reduce heart disease and diabetes by 0.3% and 1.2% with combined healthcare savings of $32 billion per year. Over a 20-year period, we're talking about $500 billion saved. Such a move would be a boon for both health and healthcare. And what is driving increased sugar consumption? It isn't a slam dunk, but in most people, dopamine plays an outsized role. Redrawing the lines of engagement. Politics makes strange bedfellows. Natural-born enemies aren't such enemies anymore. It used to be the doctors against the lawyers, the doctors against the insurers. But now, we're all on the same side for the first time. It's all the people who stand to lose, the doctors, the lawyers, the insurers, and those big businesses that have to pay the healthcare tab, against those who want to maintain the status quo, the food industry, the drug industry, the White House, and Congress. All of a sudden, we have some very rich partners with a lot of clout. Now we just have to figure out how to harness it. Healthcare is just the tip of the iceberg. The economic and social devolution of the last 40 years is unsustainable, and it's catching up to us now. Why is this happening? What are we doing wrong? The short answer is America has lost its way. The problem runs deep, like a sewer. And it stinks. The cause and cure of what ails us lies not in the art of medicine or in the politics of healthcare, but rather in the science of happiness and our wanton desire for anything and everything has betrayed us. The death spiral derives its strength from our collective unhappiness, which fuels its centrifugal force. But you can swim yourself to safety. Part 5 will show you how.